Great big thanks, Randy. Really appreciate you sharing those updates. Thanks for speaking last week. Will you join me in thanking Randy for her impact in ministry? Really appreciate you. Thanks a ton. Really do. So just a reminder, we have each week on our app at Church Center app, we have notes that are loaded up and available to tag along with the message time, some prompter questions, a discipleship path for the coming week in terms of what to read and how to be in the know, as well as questions to chew on that will help you go deeper and wider in your relationship with Jesus. We're in Esther 6 this morning, so I invite you there if you haven't gotten there yet. I find myself at times, I bet you do as well, saying something like this: "Oh God, what in the world are you up to, if anything? Oh God, what in the world are you up to, if anything?" I was asking it as Lee Wise left our little apartment. Nancy and I have been married just a couple years. I have been working on my master's degree, and the culmination of that degree was to be an internship, practicum credits into a 9 to 10 month internship experience. And Lee Wise showed up at our little apartment one afternoon, and I found myself asking that very question and saying, "Oh God, what are you up to, if anything?" He'd shown up, knocked on our door, unannounced, and he asked to come in. He had never visited our apartment before. I was like, what in the world? Oh my goodness. And he delivered this sad news. We were supposed to be headed on this internship site out in the Midwest. It was the culmination, yes, of my degree, and we had been assigned to this phenomenal location. It was this great spot, this growing place in a growing region, a multi-staff church with amazing opportunities. We'd have incredible opportunities to serve and potentially even this, you know, set up for the future in terms of incredible opportunities as a result of being in this site for internship. Amazing ops. We had met with their very cool director of this internship program from that site, and so we were so excited about working with him. The situation was exceptional, plenty of promise with it. We were thrilled. Oh, and a side benefit, the place actually paid something while you were on internship. We would get to eat. Yeah, novel concept, right? It should be nice. We would actually like be able to cover our school bill and have some food to eat, maybe a few dollars left over. And internships didn't automatically usually do that. And now Lee Wise had come personally, knocked on our apartment door, asked if he could come in and sit down. And he had told us that the internship had fallen through due to budget cuts. And I just stared at him, and he just stared back. And I said, "Okay, gulp. Now what?" "Well," Lee said, "I honestly don't know. I'll keep you posted. Let's all be prayerful. Bye." And indeed, I found myself saying, "Oh God, what in the world are you up to, if anything?" Now, that might seem like a nonplussed issue to you, situation, not that big a deal, but it was a gigantic setback in our universe for Nance and I as young 20-somethings, and we found ourselves wondering, "Oh God, what in the world are you up to, if anything?" We've all been asking, you know you have. On the world health stage, probably at some point in your own work and economics in the past months and couple years, likely in the world of your family and friendships, probably as you ponder purpose and dreams and future. Our next scene in Esther's story really stirs up such wondering. The story's been doing this all the way along, really. Right? If you've been trekking with it this summer, you know the whole story is a crisis of purpose and providence. Esther is queen in the Persian Empire. Powerful but bumbling Xerxes is king. His right-hand man, Haman, has plotted and schemed to have all the Jewish people, all of them, over the entire empire, wiped out on the 12th month, Adar. Esther's older cousin, Mordecai, is at the center of all of this, the catalyst for Haman's hatred toward the Jews. Across this tale, God's not mentioned anywhere. And we join Esther, Mordecai, and God's people wondering, oh God, what in the world are you up to, if anything? Last week, Randy helped us see the dangerous nature of pride, Haman's pride, and our own need for true humility. Esther has asked Xerxes and Haman to come back for another banquet, so more feasting and drinking the next day. Haman was in high spirits as he left the first banquet, but then quickly deflated when he sees Mordecai again sitting there in the gate, and Mordecai does not respect him. There's long-standing tribal feud between Agagites, Amalekites, and God's people, the Jews. And for Haman, there's still too much time before the month Adar rolls around and the Jews and Mordecai can be eliminated. Mordecai utterly, utterly infuriates him. As he tells his wife and friends about his great day at the banquet, but then his utter frustration at seeing this Mordecai the Jew, as he relates that, well, they just feed his flippant ego. Well, just deal with him, they say. Ask the king permission. Have him impaled on a pole. Get rid of him and you'll be rid of such feelings. End of chapter 5. Have a pole set up, reaching to a height of 50 cubits, and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai impaled on it, then go with the king to the banquet and enjoy yourself. This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the pole set up. Now, I want to just read the next scene, the whole thing, and then point out a set of stunning coincidences. And actually, very ironic coincidences, twists, and surprises. In fact, as I read, just watch for them. And before we're done, you'll walk away with some greater clarity and fresh insights, and hopefully some faith-growing hope on what God might be up to. Let's read Esther chapter 6. That night the king could not sleep, so he ordered the book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought in and read to him. Interesting method of trying to get to sleep, right? Verse 2, it was found recorded there that Mordecai had exposed Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, who had conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. What honor and recognition has Mordecai received for this? The king asked. Nothing has been done for him, his attendants answered. The king said, who is in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the palace to speak to the king about impaling Mordecai on the pole he had set up for him. His attendants answered, Haman is standing in the court. Bring him in, the king ordered. When Haman entered, the king asked him, what should be done for the man the king delights to honor? Now Haman thought to himself, who is there that the king would rather honor than me? So he answered the king, for the man the king delights to honor, have them bring a royal robe the king has worn and a horse the king has ridden, one with a royal crest placed on his head. Then let the robe and the horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man the king delights to honor and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. Go at once, the king commanded Haman. Get the robe and the horse and do just as you have suggested for Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Do not neglect anything you have recommended. So Haman got the robe and the horse. He robed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. Afterward, Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman rushed home with his head covered in grief and told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends, everything that had happened, his advisors and his wife Zeresh said to him, "Since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin." And while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried Haman away to the banquet Esther had prepared. Wow. The whole scene is ripe with laughable irony, right? Are you familiar with the song, "Isn't It Ironic"? An old man turned 98. He won the lottery and died the next day. It's a black fly in your Chardonnay. It's a death row pardon. 2 minutes too late. Isn't it ironic? Don't you think? It's like rain on your wedding day. It's a free ride when you've already paid. It's the good advice that you just didn't take. And who would have thought it? It figures. Mr. Play-It-Safe was afraid to fly. He packed his suitcase and kissed his kids goodbye. He waited his whole life to take that flight. And as the plane crashed down, he thought, well, isn't this nice? And isn't it ironic? Don't you think? It's like rain on your wedding day. It's a free ride when you've already paid. It's the good advice that you just didn't take. And who would have thought it? It figures. Well, life has a funny way of sneaking up on you when you think everything's okay and everything's going right, and life has a funny way of helping you out when you think everything's gone wrong and everything blows up in your face. And we feel it right here in Esther's story, and we feel it right here in our own lives. What stood out to you as ironic coincidences? For me, here's the irony. First, there's such ironic timing, such ironic timing. Both Xerxes and Haman are having a sleepless night. Who knows exactly why for Xerxes? Who knows why for a big bumbling old king? Haman's been busy plotting and commissioning a pole on which to impale his enemy. Xerxes asks for the ancient equivalent of an audiobook to try to put him to sleep. Persians were big on record keeping, royal chronicles. Rewarding loyal servants was serious business in the royal court. But there had been this oops. And so as Xerxes asks and he hears the answer, well, nothing was done to honor Mordecai. He hears noise in the outer court. Oh, such ironic timing. Haman, who's there? Haman. It's probably very early morning. Haman's coming to ask the king's permission to do in Mordecai. All of this timing seems like such ironic coincidence, right? Second, there's such ironic speech. Not only ironic timing, but ironic speech. The king says, "Bring Haman in." Xerxes couldn't sleep before. Now he really can't doze off, finding out that something had been left out. Somebody hadn't been honored when they should have been honored. Now he can't sleep. And well, did you catch it? He didn't even let Haman speak. Haman steps in. No space to ask his question. And the king asks his. End of verse 6. "What should be done for the man the king delights to honor?" Such ironic speech. Why? Haman is a glutton for honor. This is Haman, and we're given a window into his heart dialogue. What's stirring in his own internal conversation? Self-absorbed, already been promoted to a powerful position and consumed with the kingship and royalty and all things about the crown. In fact, likely that Haman even has his own hopes set on the throne. Haman assumes that Xerxes is thinking about some more honor to me, Haman thinks. And so he gives an answer that would be totally glorious treatment for himself and also matches the current cultural practice of what's known as royal benefaction. Royal benefaction. Other ancient records reveal such treatment as not only Persian, but Egyptian, and other kingdoms did the same. If someone was deserving of the king's special honor, these very kinds of things would be performed on behalf of the king as promotion and thanks. Haman does not miss a detail. And of course, he juices it all a bit because he thinks this is going to happen for me. Even includes the royal crest on the horse's head. Did you catch that? What a funny little inclusion. Haman's speech is so ironic. Packed with the kingly royal lingo, and he's likely envisioning himself paraded in front of his enemy. He's thinking we're going to go past the gate there where Mordecai sits, and he's going to have to see me paraded on this horse in the king's robes. He's going to have to hear it. This is what happens to the man the king delights to honor. And he's having so much fun with those words, by the way. He picked up on what the king said, and he grabs those words and he says them like a whole handful of times right here. Oh, they're rolling around on his lips and rolling off his lips. He's having fun with them, and they're going to come back to gall him in just a few minutes. And now catch some more irony. There's not only ironic timing and ironic speech, but there's such ironic reversal. Ironic reversal. Week one, I told you, along with banquets all throughout this story, watch for the tables to be turned for grand reversals. And right here, between Esther's first and second banquet, here's the start of stunning reversals, the turning point in the story. Verse 10, go at once, the king commanded Haman. Get the robe and the horse and do just as you have suggested for Mordecai the Jew who sits at the king's gate. Do not neglect anything you have recommended. Oh. The whole pace of the story picks up right here. Xerxes doesn't even give Haman time to say, wait, actually, this Mordecai guy, I was coming to talk to you about him. See, I set up this little pole in my backyard, and doesn't even have a chance to say it. What transpired was utterly humiliating for Haman. The very man he wanted to murder, he's now leading down the street, highly honored by the king. And don't forget, there were plenty of people who knew that Mordecai was a Jew. The long-standing animosity between these two characters, and Haman is forced to heap the king's accolades on his enemy. This is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. Crazy comical, right? Recall that we have the benefit of being privileged, know and see it all readers centuries removed from this event. If you were these original characters, everything's nerve-wracking and edge of puzzlement, edge of your seat. And if you're Mordecai and this is happening to you, you're still left wondering. You're riding along on the horse, still wondering. Oh, God, what in the world are you up to, if anything? Haman gets done honoring Mordecai, and he runs back home. Verse 12 says his head is covered in grief. He's so embarrassed, and his wife and counselors are no encouragement or help. End of verse 13, his advisors and his wife Zeresh said to him, since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin. Wow, not exactly encouraging friends and family, right? Wow, cold, calculated, depraved, and rude. There's inclusion of intriguing verbiage on their lips. Don't miss this. They speak of Jewish origin. Jewish origin, literally in ancient Hebrew, the seed of the Jews. The seed of the Jews. That's a pretty pregnant term, seed. Often used all across God's story to reference lineage and God's unfolding redemption story. Often that same terminology is used to speak of God's mission, of God's redemption, of the gospel. Now, we need not make too much of it or too little either. On the lips of Haman's hopeless, rascally family, there's something right here of good news, saving work for the Jews and others. And they also ironically prophesy his downfall. The lingo of falling is repeated. The lot falls on the month Adar in chapter 3, verse 7. Right here in 6:10, the king warns Haman to not let any of his royal benefaction, those plans, fall short. Don't let anything fall short, he says. In 7:8, Haman falls on the couch. We'll see it next week. It's a more irony in the scene. Oh, the sad and comedic irony of wicked intentions falling apart, falling through, and Mordecai is lifted up. A solo symbol in this moment of what's going to happen in grand reversal for a whole nation of Jews, God's people. But again, we have the post-story advantage in the thick of it, in the pressure, in the stress, in the threat. Mordecai and Esther and all the people are stuck pondering, oh God, what in the world are you up to? If anything, right on the heels of Haman's family prophesying his downfall, as they're still talking, verse 14, Haman is whisked away. The king's eunuchs show up and whisk him away. It's like he's no longer really in control, and he's not. So, how do we react when we don't readily see God working? How do you react? How do I often react when I don't readily see God working? Well, at times we throw our own little pity parties. We even throw temper tantrums when we're threatened. Oh, you don't let anybody see it, or maybe you do, but internally we throw temper tantrums. Some of us jump to action to see how we can really help God out in the situation. We scheme and we connive. I've done it, so have you. What can help us? Really help us? Well, first, resist assuming God's not doing anything. Resist assuming God's not doing anything. Just because our feelings tell us one thing, just because what you see and what you hear, your normal human perception skills tell you one thing, well, that's really not the whole story. Learn to be more inquisitive. Build some reflection rhythms into each day. I've needed to do this in the last few weeks and months. I've had plenty of times when I honestly look around and I look at situations and circumstances, and you do it as well. You just go, okay, God, what are you up to in that situation, in that person's life, in that family, and in the whole chaos of what's going on, Lord? And it's been so important. I'm trying to do better at it, to actually slow down and think and plug in some pondering points where I can actually slow down to reflect, some seasons and spots for reflection rhythm into each day. And to ask more slowly and deeply, where might I see God at work? Would you dare to do that? Would you dare to actually slow down and build into the rhythms of each day some gracious rhythms of asking, well, okay, wait a minute, I might not readily see it and hear it and sense it with my normal human perception skills, but Lord, I want to see more of where you're really at work. I'm going to slow down to reflect on that. It's so important to resist assuming God's not doing anything. Second, keep cultivating personal humility. Keep cultivating personal humility by saying, I don't have to know exactly or see exactly. I'm okay to wait for God, to wait for God's bigger story to unfold, to wait for God's bigger story to unfold. That, friends, is really the essence of faith. Think about it. To dare to say, I will slow down enough to wait for God's promises to come to fruition. Slow down enough to wait for God's mission and saving story to actually unfold. I'll wait on it. There's personal humility in that. Take this wisdom seriously. Proverbs 16:18. Pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. Before a fall. Pride. Steer clear of being a glory glutton, a glory glutton, a glory glutton, like Haman. Resist that inner voice that says, I need more praise and honor from Xerxes. We've all got a Xerxes or two in your life, or three, or five, or seven. They might be at work on the job or in your neighborhood or in that community group of friends that you're a part of, and you just love it deep down when they say, ooh, honor to you. Ooh, great job. Resist it. Don't be a glory glutton. Let the pleasure, the delight, the honor from your true, your one true king be all you need. Remember, one person to please, King Jesus. One person to please, King Jesus. Keep cultivating personal humility. Third, keep faithfully doing what you do where God has put you. Keep faithfully doing what you do, where God has put you. There's a little statement tucked into the story, top of verse 12. Afterward, Mordecai returned to the king's gate. Afterward, after what? After he'd been on the king's horse in the king's robe with a little royal crown on the horse's head, and Mordecai had said, here's what happens to the man the king wants to honor. After that had happened, what's he do? He goes back to work. He kept doing what he did, where God had put him. He just gets back to work, doing what he was assigned to do, even after he'd been honored. Did you notice? Haman rushed off, all hot and bothered by what had happened. Mordecai did not rush off all braggadocious or even assuming now he'd have full answers and full reversal of his situation. Certainly God was about to do that. No, he just kept faithfully working in his role, trusting God. There's an old tune that says, when you can't see his hand, trust his heart. When you can't see his hand, trust his heart. Here's where one more very old, vitally important truth can kick in and help. It's essential. Fourth, determine you'll trust providence. Determine you'll trust providence, his faithful story and the loving character. Determine you'll trust providence, his faithful story and loving character. Marian Ann Taylor encourages us with these concepts. She says, trusting in God's providence does not take away the pain and trauma. We do not have all the data. We can't see everything. We don't know what God is doing. Sometimes we are able to look back on our lives and make sense out of what seemed at the time to be senseless, unnecessary, or even cruel. At other times, the mystery of God's workings remains. It's probably one of the reasons, at least one of the reasons, God's missing from Esther's pages. So we'll ask and seek and trust him more. It took 2+, almost 3 months. In retrospect, not really that long, but it felt like forever. Lee Wise contacted us and we were reassigned to an internship site. Reassigned to the one place on the map we'd said we did not want to go. Isn't it ironic? That next fall we went, and it was very, very, very hard. And it was very good. All at the same time. Not right away, but over time, and now, a bunch of years later, we can look back and see both God's heart and his hand. We can see it via the people we met, the resources we connected with, and a myriad of other very unique, ironic, special coincidences. Providence, God's providence faithfully working. God faithfully keeping his promises. It's oh so likely those places you're wondering, what's God doing? If anything, are those very places where he's marvelously unfolding his salvation story, his mission in your own life and through the lives of multiple other people. Growing faith says, when I can't see his hand, I'll trust his heart. When I can't see his hand, I'll trust his heart. Let's stand together. I'm going to pray for us, and the team's going to come and lead us in a closing song. I'm going to invite you to ponder, where's your trust? Where's your trust anchored this morning? Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, thank you for such incredible providence. Thank you for your faithful promises. Help us, please, O Lord. Help us, please. Help us, please. Be humble enough, let go of our Haman-like pride, and be humble enough to trust you, your providence, your amazing promises. Please help us, precious Jesus, determined that we are eager to please you, our one true King, you alone. Help us anchor our trust deeply in you, our incredible supplier, provider, and King. Thank you, Jesus.